My name is Matt Beebe. I'm part of the team here at Midweek in Mayfair. Welcome today. It's worth saying, behind the vision of what we're doing here at Midweek in Mayfair lie three principal aims. The first is to explain the person and work of Jesus Christ as revealed to us in the Bible. And we want to explain that in a manner that is clear and relevant for those who have been living the Christian life for a long time, but also clear and relevant for those who perhaps are still thinking through what the Christian faith is all about. The second is that we want to help people to connect their faith and their work so that you don't leave your Christian faith in reception as you walk into the office in the morning. And the third is that we want to encourage each other to live out our faith at work and to think through how do we deal ethically with a lot of the issues that we'll encounter in the working week. We're still in Matthew's Gospel. Facing Life's Traumas is our title today. Matt Fuller on that for us in a moment. I'm going to read this passage from Matthew chapter 9 and then I'll pray and hand over to Matt. Let's look at Matthew chapter 9. Then John's disciples came and asked him, "How is it that we and the Pharisees fast, but your disciples do not fast?" Jesus answered, "How can the guests of the bridegroom mourn while he is with them? The time will come when the bridegroom will be taken from them. Then they will fast. No one sews a patch of unshrunk cloth on an old garment, for the patch will pull away from the garment, making the tear worse. Neither do men pour new wine into old wineskins. If they do, the skins will burst, the wine will run out, and the wineskins will be ruined. No, they pour new wine into new wineskins, and both are preserved." While he was saying this, a ruler came and knelt before him and said, "My daughter has just died, but come and put your hand on her and she will live." Jesus got up and went with him, and so did his disciples. Just then a woman who had been subject to bleeding for 12 years came up behind him and touched the edge of his cloak. She said to herself, "If only I touch his cloak, I will be healed." Jesus turned and saw her. "Take heart, daughter," he said, "your faith has healed you." And the woman was healed from that moment. When Jesus entered the ruler's house and saw the flute players and the noisy crowd, he said, "Go away. The girl is not dead, but asleep." But they laughed at him. After the crowd had been put outside, he went in and took the girl by the hand, and she got up. News of this spread through all that region. Jesus went on from there. Two blind men followed him, calling out, "Have mercy on us, son of David." When he had gone indoors, the blind men came to him, and he asked them, "Do you believe that I am able to do this?" "Yes, Lord," they replied. Then he touched their eyes and said, "According to your faith will it be done to you." And their sight was restored. Jesus warned them sternly, "See that no one knows about this." But they went out and spread the news about him all over that region. Let me lead us in prayer. Our loving Father, we thank you that you are a speaking God. And we pray now that as we take time to listen to your word, you would give us hearts and minds that hear and understand and can respond in faith. And we ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.
I don't know if you do describe yourself as optimistic or pessimistic generally. How you view life. I mean, I guess at the moment it is fairly fashionable to be pessimistic, or certainly pessimism is catching. You don't have to be Mervyn King to feel that way. But of course these things are slightly catching, and when someone decides that something is traumatic, it moves on and everyone decides that. I don't know, sometimes at the moment I feel a little bit naive. It's been a long time since I sat in economics lectures, a couple of decades ago at least. Are we just being over pessimistic? I don't know. Are we less good at handling uncertainty than previous generations? I mean, 1970s, inflation at over 20%, interest rates 15%, IMF bailing out the country. I was younger, but it seemed a lot worse than what we're in now. I don't know. I don't study these things as closely as many of you do. But is it partly that we're just less good at dealing with uncertainty and crises than perhaps we used to be? There was something in the paper this morning, The Times, it was a GP writing in, making that point really. I was largely saying that the NHS, there's finite amounts of money, people have got to manage their expectations, and saying that actually we're much more demanding now. We can't just get on with life. He compares two patients who'd come to see him yesterday, one an 87-year-old man, who would put his best suit on to come to the doctor's, and apologise profusely, "Doctor, I'm so sorry for troubling you. I really didn't want to come in and waste your time." And then, "Oh, what is the problem?" "I've got these crippling chest pains that have come on over the last couple of days." "Well, age 87, that's probably worth coming to visit me about." And then his next patient was a 21-year-old woman who arrived in her pyjamas and dressing gown and said, "I've had a sore throat this morning. Can you do something about it, please?" It's quite a difference between the symptoms and expectations and threshold for what we view as something worth troubling the doctor about. And these observations, well, just become a lot more feeble. When the NHS was formed, most people were used to fighting in wars, and they only went to see their doctor if something was wrong. But these days, well, it's just, you know, sore throat for a few hours, so I can't go to work. Can you do something about it? Now, that's just symptomatic of what sociologists would say more generally of the UK, that we're less good at dealing with trauma than once we were. We don't quite have the resources. We don't have the same family networks, the same faith basis, perhaps, even if it was nominal, that we once had. We're less good at dealing with trauma. And we come to this section, and really that's largely what this is about. Jesus addressing various different traumas of life that people are encountering. Starts off this section. Jesus has asked a question, really. He's emphasizing verses 14 to 17. He's new. He's very different to anything that's come before. So the question is fasting. Why aren't you fasting? Why aren't you going without? And Jesus answered these Pharisees, well, verse 15, "How can the guests of the bridegroom mourn while he's with them? The time will come when the bridegroom will be taken from them. Then they will fast." His point is quite a simple one. I'm a bridegroom. He's picking up an Old Testament picture of God as the groom bringing in his kingdom. He says, "I'm the bridegroom." If you go to a wedding, you don't grieve. If you happen to go to a wedding and there's a groom at the front and the bride arrives and the organist strikes up, you know, Chopin's Funeral March, as the bride wanders up the aisle, that's just a bit awkward. Everyone's going to think, that's wrong. And why is she all in black? That's not so clever either. You know, that would be incongruous. And Jesus is saying, well, I'm here. I'm so radically different to anything that's gone before. I'm bringing such enormous good news. I'm bringing in my kingdom, as is promised in the Old Testament. So don't, you know, you need to recognize that. And then these two little pictures of newness. Verse 16, "I am, unsurprisingly to say, no seamstress, but I get the image." Verse 16, "I've done my research at home." And, of course, if you put an unshrunk piece of cloth over a patch, you throw it in the washing machine, it'll shrink and probably tear off its stitches. You can't just put me into old categories, says Jesus. So simply the wineskins. Don't put new wine into old wineskins. Old wineskins are inflexible, leathery. You put wine in as it's fermenting, it'll burst. He's saying, I am so radically different to anything that's gone before. Don't try and pigeonhole me or understand me in former categories. And then the way Matthew writes it is he takes that in verse 18, while he was saying this, and off we go into these three little accounts of Jesus handling people's traumas. It seems as Matthew is saying, Jesus is completely different. And look what that means for the traumas of life, for death, for sickness of various kinds. So let's look at these three little things. There are three little stories, but 3 points on them. Let's look at the traumas of life, the necessity of faith, and then the laughter at death, briefly in turn. First then, the traumas of life. Two examples really here, sickness and death, sickness of blindness, sickness of this woman. Of course, there could be many, many more. There are many, many more traumas of life. In the 21st century, sickness scares us less, I guess, than it would have done in the first century. Medical advances can cope with lots. Cancer still scares people. But most things, most diseases, well, you can find something about that. Maybe it is financial uncertainty that we find more traumatic than actually sickness in today's day and age. But the main thing, the main account really that runs through this section is that of the little girl who's died. Death. That is unavoidable. And traumatic. Death. Verse 18. While Jesus was saying this, a ruler came and knelt before him and said, "My daughter's just died." But death is always hard. You lose your parents, as many here would have done. That's hard. It's hard to say goodbye. Hard if you hadn't had a chance to say the last thing you wanted to. But to lose a child, instinctively, is very wrong. It's the wrong way round. And to lose a young child is highly traumatic. And most parents in that situation, they have irrational guilt. We could have done more. If only we'd been there. If only we'd have tried this. There's a whole irrational guilt and physical losses if something's ripped out when a young child in particular dies. This ruler, well, the influential man, we don't know, but he comes and says, "My daughter's died." But then also verse 18, "But come and put your hand on her and she'll live." Now, confidence, it seems that way. Desperation, quite possibly that as well. Don't know quite what's going through his mind. There's no record of Jesus healing someone, there's no record of Jesus raising someone from the dead so far in Matthew's Gospel. So this would be an unprecedented thing for Jesus to do, as Matthew records his life. It's an extraordinary comment. You can do this. Just your hand. Just lay your hand and she'll be healed. In the face of this loss, Jesus does what he acts. Verse 19. Jesus got up and went with him. And so did his disciples. So a whole crowd marches off to see what could be done. But while they're doing that, Jesus is interrupted. So Matthew interrupts that account with the other one. Verse 20. A different type of suffering. Verse 20. Just then a woman who'd been subject to bleeding for 12 years came up behind him, touched the edge of his cloak. Bleeding for 12 years. Type of bleeding, it's obvious. This is the blood loss during a menstrual cycle. But clearly, something's wrong with this woman. For 12 years, there's been this trickle. And according to the laws of the Old Testament, Leviticus 15, she's excluded from society while that's taking place. She couldn't take part in religious activity. She certainly couldn't be involved. She couldn't touch Jesus. Excluded. Pushed out. Unlovable in many ways for 12 years. And she comes on the scene, miserable. We'll get to the other one very briefly later on, but verse 27, there's the other little incident. Two blind men. Now this stacking up of traumas, it's unique to Matthew's Gospel actually. These sort of incidents, the blind man heals, the woman bleeding, the girl, they're in the other Gospel accounts, they're never stacked together like this. So it seems to me that Matthew's point is Jesus is radically new and look, he can deal with all these. Let's stack them up one on top of one another. Jesus can handle every sort of trauma of life that's thrown at him. Radically new. So let's be realistic. Suffering and death, they are of course miserable. And for many, suffering and death in particular, but suffering, it's an issue that causes many to doubt Christianity. How can there be a God when there is so much suffering? How can I believe in God when my daughter has died age one? That's not uncommon. The truth is just as common, if not more so, is that suffering causes great doubt for atheists. Because in the face of suffering and death, what may cognitively make sense just doesn't work practically. Some would have come across Peter Singer. He's an Australian ethicist, fairly notorious, currently a Princeton professor of ethics. He's fairly notorious. He's a utilitarian, so argues on the basis that you should do whatever's best for general society. And he's gained a certain notoriety. I mean, the New Yorker would describe him as the most famous philosopher in the world. If you haven't heard of him, well, it doesn't say much for how much fame philosophers generally get. But he is fairly notorious. He has some controversial views, particularly on infanticide and euthanasia. Famously produced his book, Practical Ethics, about 5 years ago now, the first edition came out, wrote quite a lot on euthanasia, where he strongly advocated that anyone who's suffering with dementia should be killed, because otherwise you're wasting resources on someone who has no meaningful life anyway, and those resources should be put to better use. If you imagine that, creates a little bit of debate. When you state those things, that's starkly. Anyone suffering dementia, don't waste resources on them. Problem was, 2 years after his book came out, his mother had dementia. Sorry, she had Alzheimer's. But he and his sister, but he in particular, threw tens of thousands of any treatment possible for her. It was just questioned about this, and he simply said, "Where's your own mother? It's different. It's different." So my worldview, it's all very well, but actually when it comes to someone I love, it's very different. So this year, the book's been released again, a new edition, and he comments in the foreword, I mean, with some honesty, "I found myself unable to maintain with any confidence that the position I took in the previous edition of my book offers a satisfactory answer to the issues of life and death." I mean, it's quite a humble thing to say, because essentially he's saying, my last book was rubbish, really. It just doesn't work, if I'm honest. You can't live by it. Was it suffering and death? Yeah, they're difficult issues if you call yourself a Christian. Some people reject Christianity. Very difficult issues if you hold yourself to be an atheist. Or to ground it even more, if you ever have the misery of, it's misery, but the funerals of infants are very traumatic occasions. Very few of those that I had to do, but one earlier this year, always heart-rending. In this case, the parents were believers, Christians, and the child died only a few hours after being born. But when a father carries a coffin, which is basically the size of a shoebox, you just think that's wrong. Everything in you says that's wrong. But it's very striking to me talking to friends of the couple after the funeral. One man in particular, again, with great honesty, said, I said, you know, where do you know the couple from? Okay. Oh, how do you find a service such as this? And one man very honestly said, "Well, to be straight with you, Vicar, I call myself an atheist. It's very hard to believe that on a day like today. It's not good enough." So these traumas of life, yeah, they're complicated and they throw up issues for Christianity, but even more complicated if you've got nothing else. Certainly there's two individuals who said, you know, my atheist work, it doesn't work. It's not good enough when it comes down to it. There are traumas of life. Now, look secondly, these miracles that Jesus performs, the necessity of faith. That seems to be the reason that Matthew inserts the woman's healing into the middle of the girl's story, really. So verse 18, he's talking to the ruler, "My daughter's died, come with her." Jesus gets up and goes with her. But then verse 20, just then a woman who'd been subject to bleeding comes up behind him, touches the edge of his cloak. Now, but the emphasis here seems to be on her faith. So verse 21, she said to herself, "If only I can touch his cloak, I'll be healed." Jesus turned and saw her. "Take heart, daughter, your faith has healed you. Your faith has healed you." It seems she kind of approaches Jesus in a somewhat superstitious manner. "If I can just touch the cloak. If I can just swim in the waters of Lourdes, maybe my cancer will go. If I can just drink from water from the Holy Grail, maybe my bullet wounds will disappear." Whatever it may be, you know, that sort of, I mean, just touch wood and everything will be alright. "If I can just touch the hem, all will be well." And Jesus recognises what she's doing, but says, "Come on, let's talk about what's going on here. There's nothing, it's a little superstition, nothing about my hem." But he's very gentle with her. Verse 22, "Take heart, daughter." It's very lovely. This woman who's been excluded for 12 years of her life. "I'm about to go and heal a dead daughter, and now my daughter, I'm going to heal you as well." I mean, the daughter, he's very tender. But he says to her, the emphasis is, your faith has healed you. It's faltering. It's weak, it may be a little bit confused. "I'm not quite sure what I'm doing, but I know this man is special. But that's okay. In one sense, the variety of faith in these accounts is very different. You've got the ruler, verse 18, he seems to be very confident. You've got the woman, well, she seems somewhat superstitious. You've got the blind men, well, they're damn right disobedient. He heals them. Jesus says, don't go and tell anyone. Oh, let's go tell everyone. I mean, they're sort of, the variety of their faith is different. But that's normal. Deficiencies in faith, they're quite common. The crucial thing in all three of these accounts is the object of their faith. That's Jesus. The object of their faith is what matters. So one is confident, one is somewhat superstitious, two are disobedient. But they have faith in Jesus. That's what matters. The substance of the object, not the quality, the volume of the faith. Does that make sense? Imagine a family whose house is on fire. Mum, dad, two kids, their house is on fire. And they realise a bit late. And they're upstairs and the fire is raging. So they need to jump out of the bedroom window. But it's okay. There's four firemen with one of those big bouncy nets that you bounce onto beneath. And the children think, well, this is quite fun. So the children just throw themselves out, boing and bounce, and they're quite, come back! And there's a coughing a little bit. Now, mum and dad are a little bit uncertain. You know, dad in particular, well, how are you then? Yeah, that's alright, you're 7 stone, I'm 14 and some. I'm less certain. So more gingerly, he sort of closes his eyes and just sort of jumps out a little bit. And even as he's falling, thinks, is this going to work? I don't know if this is going to work. But bounces in the net and it's fine. And so what does it matter? It doesn't matter whether you throw yourself out with confidence, whether you very nervously, uncertainly think, is this okay? Is this going to work? The important thing is you just throw yourself out. That you put your faith in the firemen and their net, and all are saved, all are well. So that is true with Jesus Christ. Some people have a rock solid faith. Here we go, and I know I can trust Jesus and everything. Others are, life is complicated. Jesus, I trust you, but you're going to come through? Probably, hopefully. Not so sure at the moment. I know I do trust you, but here we go. Let's see what happens. But the object of faith is still the same. It doesn't matter if your faith is strong, your faith is weak. He still catches you if you jump into him. And that's what he's pointing out here. That it's the necessity of faith. Whatever traumas you face, you just need to have faith that Jesus will catch you. No matter how strong that is. So the traumas of life, necessity of faith. Lastly, the laughter of death. Well, eventually in this account, Jesus makes it to the girl's house. Verse 23, when Jesus entered the ruler's house and saw the flute players and the noisy crowd, he said, go away. Now, this is not because he just hates flautists and doesn't like blowy wind instruments. It is because these are the professional mourners, even the poorest family. You know, if there's a death, you get the flute players and the professional wailers to come. But Jesus says, we don't need you. It's like today, you arrive at someone's house. And Jesus arrived at someone's house, and there's the co-op funeral services have helpfully arrived, and they're about to take away the body. Get out, we don't need you. He's not dead. The person's not dead. The girl's not dead. Go away. Nice to see you, but later. I mean, come back in 40 years' time or something, but not yet. He said, that's why he dismisses these people. Now there's laughter. So, verse 24. The crowd, generally, they laugh at him. I don't know, that's a nervous laughter. it's just a bit awkward, the girl is dead. Or maybe now they're laughing because they think Jesus will become unstuck. Okay, the great healer. Yes, he's done some things, but this girl is dead. She's been dead since the beginning of this account, since dead 18. Now he's going to come unstuck. Well, let's see what you do now. You lot, get out. Get out. And very simply, he goes in. Verse 25. After the crowd has been put outside, he went in, took the girl by the hand, and she got up. It's very lovely, isn't it? Very simple. Most here, I don't know, would have had children, or I don't know if you can remember the age and stage. When the children are very young, and they have their 2 hours sleep or something after lunch, blissful, particularly if you've only got one child, amazing. You sort of put them down for 2 hours, and then you can have an hour's sleep and read them. Oh, amazing. Anyone remember that stage? If it's to come, that's great. That's the best 2 hours of the day. But if you do get that, and for once they've done what they're meant to do, and they have slept for 2 hours, and eventually someone in the house says, we should probably go and wake up Lucy. And you think, well, I guess so, otherwise maybe she won't sleep tonight. You sort of rouse yourself and you go up. Because they've had a lovely sleep, it's beautiful maybe, so you wander into the child's room, and depending on the age, you may unswaddle if they're very young. Or maybe a 1-year-old or something, just a little stroke on the face. And you say, Lucy, come and wake up. Sit up, smile, happy, and you think, oh, if you were like this all the time, I really would be the happiest man or wife around, or whatever it may be. You say, wake up, huh? It's that sort of picture. Jesus, verse 25, he takes the girl's hand, come on, and she goes, oh, yeah. He takes her hand, reaches into death, and pulls her out of death. Wake up, okay. Yeah, it's very lovely. And he can do the same for you and for me. Because if you have your faith in Jesus Christ, death is just like sleep. And he'll say, look, if I hold your hand, death is just sleep to you, and one day I'll pull you out. And we're both, and you'll go, here I am, in heaven with Jesus. Woof. And he'll say, yeah, come on, let's go. Let's go. We've got things to do now. We're going to have a lot of fun in this place. And so the people laugh at Jesus, but ultimately, well, he laughs at death. Come with me. And he pulls a girl out of death. What extraordinary power that is. So obviously, look, traumas will come in this life. They're inevitable. But knowing that Jesus holds your hand, that makes every difference in the world to how you face them. Now, in these sort of traumas of life that these people experienced, now, I don't know why the girl had to die. I don't know why the woman had to wait 12 years before Jesus stepped in. I don't know. We're not told. But he did step in. And whatever traumas face us, death are ones we love. Our own death will come at some point. Sickness, instability, financial traumas, whatever may come. I don't know why they have to happen to you or me. Will Jesus step in and help in them? I don't know. We're not told that after. But he has stepped in. And he will certainly step in to pull you out of death if your faith is in him. And that changes everything. That changes everything. He'll pull you out of death. He'll laugh with you when you wake from that. That's a radically different complexion on whatever we face in this life. It means that we can face the traumas with a little bit more resolve. And that of a 21-year-old in her pyjamas who says, I've got a sore throat. Jesus laughs at death, and we can laugh with him if we put our faith in him. Let me lead us in prayer. Father, thank you that Jesus is radically different. He was radically different in those times. You couldn't pigeonhole him, you couldn't put him into old wineskins, because the kingdom that he brings in, the power that he has, is just unprecedented, and no one touches him. Thank you that he clearly can deal with the traumas faced by the people in these passages. If we place our faith in him, we can have confidence that he is with us, holding our hands through the uncertainties of life, and whatever they may throw, we can have confidence that he'll catch us in our death and pull us back to life with him for eternity. Now, would that make all the difference to us as we face our week this week? Amen.